Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Well, holidays are rapidly approaching. Tomorrow we're going to talk a little bit about the history of Thanksgiving and how it became, all that good stuff. I think we grow up in a world where things are just accepted. A lot of times we don't even talk about why is it we have turkey on Thanksgiving, or why is it this and why is it that. So I thought it'd be fun to do a little story on that tomorrow. And I have a very special day planned for Thursday as well. For those of you who get up at the crack of dawn on Thursday, even though you don't have to work, I hope you'll join us, because I have lots of friends calling in to let us know what they're grateful about. But today, because every day that I watch the news and every day that I pay attention to what's going on in the world, all the big stuff, the catastrophes that happen all over the world, the discord that's taking place in all over the world, if I pull it all in, what's still happening is really, really mean stuff right here in our own backyard. And by that I mean crimes, injustices to other people done by other people. And, of course, a lot of them have to do with young people. And I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that we have to do something about this, that it's not okay to pretend or to put our head in the sand and pretend that we don't know what's going on in the outside world. One of the things that caught my attention a few weeks ago, and I did talk about it, was Philip Chisholm. For some reason, this young man came to school prepared to kill and harm his teacher. And he's been found guilty, but nobody knows why. Nobody can find out what made this young man come into school. Wait, they have him on video in the school in a hooded jacket going into the bathroom after the teacher goes in. They see the teacher go in. He goes into the bathroom. He not only stabs her with a utility knife, but he also rapes her with an object. And another student comes in and sees a naked backside and thinks somebody is going to the bathroom or changing their clothes or something, and that student leaves the bathroom. And it was a girl, because it was the ladies' room. And when she leaves, out he comes, and he goes to all the trouble, and this is during a school day, and gets like a garbage can or something, and takes the teacher out and dumps her, and they find her body. They find him walking on the street. His mother reports him missing. They find him walking on the street, pick him up, and then the parents of the teacher report that she's never come home. The only thing that they can figure out that happened to this young man's brain to disconnect or snap or whatever happened that day was because he just went through a very nasty divorce with his parents, and they were living in Tennessee. And the teacher talked about Tennessee in the classroom. Now, what does that tell us? I think it tells us, as usual, we're not paying enough attention to what's going on with these young people. There were no, you know, they couldn't find any drugs in his system. They drug tested him. They did everything. They couldn't find anything going on with him. He really has no excuse, according to every article I read. He doesn't even give a reason. But that's a horrific crime. That's not just, you know, like some of the other horrible things we read about that are bad enough, but this was like plotted and planned and carried out. Then the next episode is a young woman who thinks it's amusing to Twitter about how wasted she is. And they show all these different tweets that she's done on her Twitter account about how baked she is or how high she is. Now, she could be doing that just to be entertaining and to, you know, to make all of her friends think that she's just super cool. because we all know that kids think a little bit differently than adults think, not all the time, but some of the time, that's funny. Not that it's cool, that it's funny. And anything that's funny is worth listening to. Watch your teenagers or your young kids in front of the television. Funniest home videos, where people fall down, where people get hurt, cracks everybody up. So she's tweeting all this kind of stuff, and she actually tweets, "Too drunk to drive," goes out, gets in a car, and hits another car, and two young women, 20 and 21 or something along those lines, 20 and 22, one dies at the scene and the other one dies in the hospital. I can't emphasize how awful this is, how without any kind of explanation, why is that amusing? And why is it something that our young people seem to be proud of? I see and hear all the time, "Oh man, I was so effed up, I couldn't see what I was doing, and blah, 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 how funny it was." And I'm like, you're really proud of that. Losing control is something that they think is funny, entertaining, and makes them a big shot. Something's wrong with that. Something is very, very wrong with that. So you have all these things that are going on here every day, and I could have printed out 10 that have just taken place in the last 6 months in regard to things like this, with young people thinking, well, maybe not thinking, that things like this are amusing, or things like this are appropriate, or things like this are okay if they plan it out and can get away with it. I don't understand it. I don't understand what happens with that major disconnect to have respect for other people's lives or other people, period. I'm going to bring in Shelley, because eventually we're going to talk. I found a really good article on what happened at Sandy Hook, and I think there's a lot of unanswered questions about that, so we're going to talk about that too. Good morning, Miss Shelley. Shelley, I know she's here.
Oh, sorry, I forgot to take the mute off. You know, I have very noisy dogs. They sit here and they'll cough or they're sitting there scratching themselves. I was on the phone the other day and a woman asked me who was running in the background, and my dog Leo was flapping his ears. Shaking his head, he's got these long floppy ears, and she thought there was somebody running in the background. So,
oh, that's funny.
Sometimes they start talking to me.
Yeah, sometimes I hear them too, but I always know who they are. So these last two things, this Philip Chisholm thing, is horrendous, with yet again no explanation, and I guess you can't look at somebody, if you're in the position of authority, you can't look at somebody and say, "What the hell were you thinking? Why did you do that?" and get a straight answer, because maybe there is no answer. Maybe it's just simply, like I just said, a disconnect. We talk a lot about how we're you know, we're all electric, and that a lot of the things that we do is because we're not staying connected in ourselves. And I suppose that could be part of the reason that young people do things like this. I don't know. I really, really don't know. But I do know that, like I just said, what makes them laugh, what makes all of us laugh, is people getting hurt. Not hurt, killed hurt. Then people, you know, and usually people rise up, especially adults, more often than children, I guess. But if you watch Funniest Home Videos, you know, somebody slams down on the ground, or some old lady decides that she can go down a slide and get stuck on a slide and then falls off the other side of the slide, and everybody's hysterical, and they win $10,000 watching Grandma fall off the slide.
Well, you know, I have to say something, because I watch those, and sometimes I'll laugh hysterically at some of the stuff, but I only laugh at the ones where it's obvious the person didn't get hurt. It's more like they were just goofy, you know, they fell, they were clumsy. I laugh at clumsiness because it's funny, I laugh at my own clumsiness. But if I don't see the full clip, if I don't see the person getting up after, it actually invokes concern in me. And I know that that's unusual and probably most people don't go there, but I do. I don't like seeing people get hurt. I get a kick out of clumsiness because that's funny. It's like slapstick comedy. But
right.
With the person stands up at the end, I know that they really didn't get hurt. You know what I'm saying? So for me, it's a little bit more refined than that. I don't enjoy watching people get hurt. I don't think it's funny. But I do think it's funny when people are clumsy and they fall or they trip, because that action is comical when we move in a goofy way, you know. So
I don't disagree with that. Of course, I would laugh too. I laugh, like you just said, I laugh at myself when I do something foolish like that.
So I'm wondering if it's
a general way of just not having any, you know, not giving any thought when you're 10. And are they thinking, oh my God, I bet that lady broke her hip? I doubt it.
Yeah.
You know. And it's scary to think that becomes so funny, because then it becomes okay.
Yeah.
Like so many other things that we do that we see. And instead of thinking, you know, that was very funny, but I hope that person's okay, it becomes just funny. And then you see kids do it to each other, tripping each other, or like the pranks. Have you watched any of the shows where they prank each other? And some of those things, people, they have to get hurt a little bit. They have to.
I know.
You can't just fall down on your head or on your knees or something like that and not get hurt a little bit.
Yeah, I used to be a prankster when I was younger, when I was at different jobs and my friends and stuff. But our pranks were always, they were just funny. Nobody ever got hurt. Nobody ever had a chair pulled out from under them. I mean, those type of pranks I don't think are funny, because you never know what can happen to somebody. You know, you have somebody who's got a problem with their back, you're not aware of them, and you pull a chair out from under them and you let them fall. I don't think that's funny. You know, but I know people
are
kind of funny, you know. Our pranks were more, you know, like little annoying things, like, you know, a friend of mine who was also my boss, I played a prank on her. So that night she stapled all my work to my desk pad. So when I came in the next morning, every piece of paper was stapled on top of another piece of paper. I had to remove like 100 staples before I could start my work, because every sheet of paper was stapled to my desk pad. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, that is funny.
Yeah, those are the type of pranks we used to play with each other. We never did anything that could hurt each other. You know, but it made it fun. It made it a little like, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen to me today or coming into work, because I know I just did something to somebody else. But it was those type of playful pranks, you know, just goofy, you know, just the person laugh and know that you had them in your target, you know. But never to hurt anybody. And those type of pranks we actually look very down on. Somebody did get hurt because of pranks somewhere where I work, and the rest of the staff was really upset with the person that pulled the prank and let them know quite bluntly that wasn't okay. But
yeah, It isn't,
now,
it isn't funny if somebody gets hurt.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going out with friends that used to say things like, oh, my God, you know, oh, my God, I got so wasted, I didn't even remember what I was doing, and then they couldn't get out of bed the whole next day. And I used to listen to them talk, and these people were, like, in their 40s. I mean, we're talking adults. We're not talking teenagers or people in their 20s that still aren't fully baked yet. I'm talking adults. And here they're 40 years old, and they're still going out, can't wait for Friday so they can go out and get drunk. Now, I got drunk when I was younger, but I didn't like the way it felt the next day, so it wore off. Over time, I got to the point where I didn't like getting that wasted. I didn't like the way it felt the next day. I never got out of control even when I was drunk. I know it may sound like a strange thing to say, but I didn't. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't like getting drunk, because I didn't like not having a sense about myself, you know. But it stopped for me because I literally didn't like waking up and not feeling good the next day. And yet I know people that 20, 25, 30 years later, that's still a way of life for them. They never disconnect from that like needing to just escape for a weekend. You know, Friday night hits, and they're not okay until Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I think hangovers saved a lot of us from being drunks, to be honest with you. I think a hangover, if you were, let's put it this way, if you were lucky enough to be in your teens and get really messed up a couple different times and woke up the next day and wish you hadn't woke up, then it may have saved your ass. But some people just get up and drink again so that they don't feel so bad. So, but that's a whole other story or a whole other show. But what bugs me is the bragging about it, the bragging rights of losing control. I don't like ever. Maybe it's just me, but I don't like ever having anybody think that I'm not in control. And I guess that could be that I'm a control freak, which is probably true, but I don't like having anybody else pass that judgment on me. Oh, look at Renee. She doesn't even know what the hell she's doing. I don't like that. So if you don't like that, you know, maybe that keeps you out of that realm. But to post it or to do something that lets everybody know how out of control you are, How does that serve you? I don't get it. Am I missing something?
Well, see, this is another thing about all the social media, and we've talked about this before. Number one, to say it is bad enough. To share it amongst your friends is bad enough, okay? Because, like you said, I don't think it's something you should be proud of, all right? And I think they say it more maybe because they are feeling bad about it, and sometimes when you say something to get approval from friends, you're trying to talk yourself into the fact that it's okay, and you want to see if other people will laugh along with you, that type of thing. So I'm not really so sure if they are proud of it or if they're just trying to, you know, like when you yell at somebody and they say they don't care, but they're saying they don't care and they really do. Like a kid gets in trouble and you yell at them and they go, well, I don't care. Well, of course they care. They're saying that as a defense mechanism. So part of it may be that, but the other part of it is that putting it out on a social media, now you have a permanent record that if you ever do something stupid, you have it in black and white out there that any attorney worth their salt can now take your Facebook postings or your social media postings and use them against you. Like this girl now, they know she was drunk because she tweeted it all over the place and then had this horrific accident. You know, mm-hmm. So even if they didn't blood test her, they have her admission. They have her intent. They have her going out there and just carelessly hurting somebody, knowing that she was that screwed up.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are going to do a show on that about social networking and the things that you put on it and the availability, even though we've talked about the fact that we know that people can look and people can see and people can watch and people know what you're doing all the time. Just in case you don't get the gist of it, but we're not going to go into it today, but it is, you need to be careful what you post for the rest of the world to see, because not that I'm trying to get you to protect yourself against doing something wrong, because that's not my intent, but sometimes a harmless, what you think is amusingly funny posting could could come back and be misconstrued in many different ways. So it is smart or smarter to, you know that it's a social network and that all kinds of people, not just your friends, but the friends of your friends and the friends of their friends, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are able to see postings. If they don't know you, anything about you, and you make a certain kind of a post that your friends will get because, oh, that's Rini, she does that stuff. She doesn't mean what she said. She would never do that. That's a joke.
Right.
Somebody who three lines down in that friendship circle doesn't know that. So
right. You're
right. If you do something, or if you're under scrutiny, or say you don't do anything, somebody else does something to you, and you try to get something done about it, they will go to your social network. They will see what kind of postings you do because they want to find out what kind of a person you are. And if at face value your Facebook page, your Twitter page looks like you're kind of a hellraiser and you've done this and you've done that, you lose credibility.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You lose a lot
of
credibility.
Well, we won't go too far on this right now, but they even taught us that when we were going in for when you go to places like places that recruit you for employment, the labor board and things like that, they actually tell you to make sure you clean up your Facebook page and there's not a lot of nonsense on there because prospective employers look at people's Facebook pages now because they want to see what kind of content they have on there, what kind of comments they draw and how they talk to their friends and stuff. It really goes to your character. And people don't understand. They're putting it out there forever. This is my character. Listen to what I have to say. And they don't realize they're not just talking amongst their friends where it goes away. They're creating permanent records about their character.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, case in point, and then we'll get back to the to Philip Chisholm, I think he said his name was, is that I was watching Judge Judy last night, and there was a case on there where a girl had left her tenancy early, or like 7 months early, because they were all teenagers. They were renting an apartment together, like 18-year-olds. And the mother of one of the kids threatened her because she didn't like how she was acting, but she threatened her on Facebook. This is a grown woman, threatened the other tenants on Facebook. And that's why she left the tenancy early. She printed out the Facebook entry and handed it in as evidence. Judge Judy read it and said, she said, you're a grown woman and you put something like this out on a social media. And she judged in favor of the plaintiff because she read it as a true threat. She says, I would have moved out also. She said, how do you put something like this in writing? And the woman's like, well, I didn't mean that. She said, it doesn't make any difference. She said, I have it in print. She says, I'm reading this as a threat. She said, I would have left also. She said, you're not entitled to the rest of the rent. And they actually had a legal case decided because this woman put a threat out on Facebook.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of times we've talked about that at length. And again, we will do a social network day. And really talk about the harm, the help, the benefits, the downside of belonging to a social network. I had an interesting conversation very recently with a lawyer who told me some things that blew me away. So we will talk about that.
But there's another thing that ties into what we're talking today about with Philip Chisholm and this other girl. Here is the adult in this case. And instead of going over there and sitting down and talking to the three young people, the three students, or pulling that one to the side and say, look, what is going on? The three of you were friends before you moved in here. I want to know what's going on. I don't like the behavior. You guys are either going to have to work this out or one of you is going to have to move. Now, that would have been an adult thing to do. But no, this woman who's the role model, who's the adult, is Facebooking this other teenager on Facebook, and they're going back and forth, and she's, like, arguing with her and threatening her. I mean, what kind of sense does that make? How is that an adult thing to do? So here the parent was setting a completely wrong example instead of defusing the situation, she made it worse and then got the girl so freaked out that she actually moved out, where she had an actual opportunity to help these kids mend fences. Because most things that happen between teenagers are usually blown out of proportion, and if you can get them talking, it usually blows over. It's when they start talking to other people instead of each other that things escalate, because everybody throws their two senses in and adds fuel to the fire. And that's exactly what this mother did. She just added fuel to the fire and made a bad situation get horrifically worse until the girl just finally moved out.
Well, and that, you're right, that happens all the time. And plus that, you know, have you ever had somebody come to you on a personal level, something happened to them, and they incite you? They make you feel like you need to step up and do something because they've just given their rendition of something, and they actually hit all of your pressure points, and you feel so incited that you have to go and do something about it. And then 3 hours later, you're like, what the hell was I thinking? Why is that even any of my business? Why didn't I keep my mouth shut? Why didn't I stay out of that? Because people can do that to us. People can come to us and tell us something that sounds so unjust, and especially if it's somebody that you care about, and all of a sudden you're jumping on the proverbial bandwagon for something you don't necessarily even feel, you know, drawn to or want to take a stand about. But the other person telling you what happened has you all excited about it, and you move with that. It's always wise, and I know most of us don't do it, but it's always wise when somebody tells you anything to mull it over before you go running out the door to do something about it. I know that firsthand. You know, many, many times in my life I've attacked something because of something someone else told me, and I did it in that moment, and I was never not sorry afterwards, never that I can remember. And maybe I should have done something, but I should have calmed myself down and then done it, because it would have been handled a lot more properly. But, you know, that's called self-control, and that's something you have to teach yourself. Somebody else can't teach you about it.
All right.
So the other, this Kayla Mendoza is the one that tweeted too drunk to drive, and she's obviously going to be in big trouble, and more than likely do some serious jail time. Philip has been found guilty, but I haven't seen anything about his sentencing yet. But both stories, sad in themselves, and let's face it, somebody loved Philip, and I'm sure Kayla, the pictures that I saw, she's adorable. I'm sure people loved Kayla too. So poor decisions are part of this life, and
Anything on we'll go to Philip in a minute, but anything on Kayla Chisholm after the fact? Is she showing any remorse? Is she still flippant about it? And anything about her demeanor now
I haven't seen anything except for the fact that she posted that, thought it was amusing, had posted. They showed several posts by her. Where she posted her friends, you know, I'm baked, or I'm this, or I'm that. And maybe it became her, you know, her trademark. I don't know. And maybe it didn't even really mean something. Wouldn't it be amusing if we found out that she was stone sober and she wrote that just because she thought it was funny? How harmful is that?
Really.
Oh, you know. But at this point in time, no. I didn't find anything, not on any of the sites that, you know, are really current.
Right.
She hasn't even been, there hasn't even been a, what do you call it, an arraignment or anything, I don't think, yet.
This happened recently.
Yeah.
When did the incident happen? When did the Philip Chisholm incident happen?
That's been a couple of months ago. We talked about it when it first happened, maybe just a month ago. But, yeah, he's already been to court. He's already been found guilty. I mean, they have pictures of him and everything. That's one of the things that I found to be, we've talked about this before, too, the cameras in the schools. They're going to be worth their weight in gold, I think, in the future. And I don't know. I would assume young people know that there's cameras. All my kids know where the cameras are in the school. They've talked to me about it. And but
well, was he denying that he did anything when they first found him? Or they don't go in?
No, he still had blood on his hands. He still had the utility knife. He had gloves. He had everything still in his pockets in this hoodie that he had.
Wow.
So like I said, there had to have been, I mean, and because somebody talks about the state where your parents got divorced, that creates, I mean,
I think that's a stretch. I find that I think that lacks credibility. I can't see your parents getting divorced and somebody mentions the state they came from and then it turns you into a homicidal lunatic. That's an extremely aggressively violent act. You just ended somebody's life. There's more to that. This kid either suffered abuse. You know, who knows why the parents were getting divorced, but I think as this story unfolds, you're either going to find out that this kid, if he wasn't on drugs, and just because the newspaper says they found no drugs in him, I got to tell you, I've heard of a couple of stories recently where drugs were involved and the media said no drugs were involved, and then 6 months later, they come out with an update, and we find the drugs were involved. So I don't necessarily believe that yet because his actions were too violent, too extreme, too unwarranted. You know, either this teacher was doing something to him, and this was retaliation, and nobody knows about it yet, or he was being abused somehow, but you don't just fracture mentally like that for no reason. Something happened to precipitate this. Either that or this kid was a stone-cold sociopath and was growing up to be a serial killer, and there was something wrong with him from day one, which means he's probably been torturing animals and stuff. I mean, there's been some history there. You don't just wake up one morning, go into school, and turn into a homicidal lunatic. It doesn't happen that way. Something led up to it.
Well, I don't
either.
That show.
Go ahead.
I don't know about that. If there's a disconnect, yes, you can just lose it in a heartbeat. You're right that there's always, for every one of us, there's extenuating circumstances, and you're probably right on with the fact that other stuff has happened to this child, but it's not unheard of for somebody to just like I said before, the flow of our own bodies, our own circuit center, if there's a disconnect, God knows what you're going to do. God knows. I mean,
right, but you're not talking about staying in the heat of the moment. You're talking about something premeditated. Premeditated is not disconnect. Premeditated is thought out, dwelled on. He probably considered this for days. All right, this was too, like you said, this was too premeditated. This wasn't something that happened in the spur of a moment where all of a sudden he's sitting in his classroom, snaps, and goes after this teacher.
I disagree with that, too. I think that you can disconnect and still have your wits about you. I think you can disconnect with something and believe that this is what you need to do because of the disconnect. And there can be plotting. I am sure in history, a lot of the horrible premeditated things were done was because somebody had a total disconnect. And, I mean, look at the women that have plotted as soon as the husband goes to work to go through and methodically kill their children. There's a disconnect there. Is there a history? Yes, but all of a sudden it got too much to handle and there's a disconnect. For me, it has to be that. I can't explain it any other way to Remy. I don't know that I'm making myself clear trying to explain it to everybody else, but in my own head, I cannot think of any other explanation other than they lose it. They lose
right.
It. It doesn't mean that they can't think
but
about
you're using
what
the word disconnect, but what you're talking about is that there's that one intervening moment where they go from hanging on to snapping.
Yes.
Basically.
And there can be premeditation after that snap. Doesn't mean they quit functioning. And it's something that a doctor or a stethoscope or a scan can find. It's just snapped. It's like a rubber band, and it's gone, and there's no connection there anymore. And I think through history, it's happened many, 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 many times. And sometimes after a horrendous act like that, I think there's a reconnect. And then that's why you find people who are okay with being punished and, you know, shoot themselves or say, you know, lock me up and throw away the key. I did it. I deserve this. Whatever the case might be. We're strange. Human bodies, human beings are strange. And the way our brains work is, I don't care who studies it. I don't know if they'll ever know because we're all so different. And there's a different situation for every situation. So I want to move on to this story, though, because we won't have time to get it all in unless I do it right now with a couple of the things I want to do. You remember about the Sandy Hook school that was horrific. He killed himself, he killed his mom, and he killed 26 other people. And 20 of them were children, and 6 were staff people at Sandy Hook Elementary. In Newtown, Connecticut, it remains a mystery and probably always will be. Investigators say that they weren't able to determine what impelled Adam Lanza to kill his mother in her bed, then drive the short distance to Sandy Hook Elementary School and slaughter 26 children and educators last December 14th, and finally kill himself. A summary investigative report released by the state's attorney's office Monday offering chilling details of 20-year-old Lanza's killing rampage, including 10 minutes of terror inside the elementary school he once attended. But investigators said they could not determine a motive or an explanation for his actions. They found, however, mysterious clues. In fifth grade, Adam Lanza wrote a book that included tales of children being slaughtered and a son shooting his mother in the head.
In fifth
in the
grade?
Years of, yeah, fifth grade. In the years that followed, he was obsessed with mass murders, assembling articles, photos, books, footage, and violent videotapes, including one in which players gunned down students in a school. He even kept a spreadsheet ranking mass murders. The report said Lanza acted alone and did not conspire with others to unleash his bloody attack. State investigators said that their review of computer and social media data showed Lanza had a preoccupation with mass shootings, particularly the Columbine High School shootings in Littleton, Colorado, in 1999. He shot his mother in the head as she lay in bed the morning after returning from an out-of-town trip with her son, the report said. Lanza then left the house and drove his 2010 Honda Civic to the school, where he shot his way through the locked entrance, killed 2 administrators, and wounded 2 others before entering 2 classrooms filled with children, firing his semi-automatic rifle with deadly effect. Killed first was the principal, Dawn Hochsprung, and a school psychologist, Mary Sherlock, in the north hallway, the report said. After wounding 2 others, he walked into the classroom and killed 20 children and 4 teachers. The final shot at the school was fired 63 seconds after the first Newtown police officer arrived at the school. About 5 minutes later, officers entered the building. The report gives an account of Lanza's spree. The first 911 call to police was received at 9:35. At 9:36, a dispatcher broadcast that there had been a shooting at Sandy Hook School. The first Newtown police officer arrived at the school at 9:39. So we're talking about 4 minutes. And two more officers arrived 13 seconds later. Gunshots were heard. At 9:39, a police officer encountered an unknown male running along the east side of the school. At 9:40, the last gunshot was heard. At 9:44, Newton police officers entered the school. Lanza, 20, using a Bushmaster XM15 E2S rifle to kill the victims at Sandy Hook School before killing himself there with a Glock 10mm handgun. He killed his mother, Nancy, in her bed with a .22 caliber rifle. The Connecticut State Police's full evidence file about the shootings, which total thousands of pages, was not released Monday. Police found numerous violent video games in the basement of the Lanza home, but most of the people who knew Lanza and were interviewed by police said they had no explanation for his actions. The autopsy performed on Nancy Lanza determined that the cause of death was multiple gunshots to the head, the report says. An autopsy of Adam Lanza on the same day revealed that Lanza was 6 feet tall and weighed 112 pounds. That's like a string bean. No drugs were found in his system. 1 month before the shooting, Nancy Lanza sought to buy her son another computer or parts for a computer to build himself, the report said. She was concerned about him and said he hadn't gone anywhere in 3 months. She said she would communicate. She said he would communicate with her only by email, although they lived in the same house. She never expressed fear of Adam or concern about her safety, the report said. She planned to sell her new town home and move to Washington State or North Carolina so her son could go to a special school or get a computer job. She planned to buy a recreational vehicle where Adam could sleep while the house was being shown to prospective buyers because Adam would not sleep in a hotel, the report says. He refused to leave the home and go to a hotel when the home lost power during Hurricane Sandy in October 2012. In November 2012, Nancy Lanza wanted to buy her son a CZ-83 pistol for Christmas and prepared a check for that purpose. At around 5:30 a.m. on December 10th, 4 days before the shootings, Nancy told a friend that Adam had bumped his head badly. There was some bleeding, but he was okay. Nancy left for a trip to New Hampshire and cooked Adam's favorite food before she left. She went to New Hampshire without him and returned October 13th at around 10 p.m. the night before she was killed. While Nancy was away, a GPS device in the Lanza home showed that a trip was made from 2:09 p.m. to 2:32 p.m. on December 13th, the day before the shootings. The trip was to and from the Sandy Hook area from the Lanza house and was presumably made by the shooter in his black Honda Civic. Lanza said it appears to have had no, I'm sorry, Lanza, it says, appears to have had no continuing involvement with the school after he went there as a youth. He attended from 1998 to 2003, first through fifth grades, the report said. He was not assigned to the two classrooms where the shootings occurred. In 2005, the report says Lanza was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. I want someday to talk about Asperger's because of all the diagnosis and all of the challenges out there. Asperger's, for me, is one of the most confusing and most involved with all kinds of tentacles, you might say, that I find very, very interesting, and maybe we could get some help on that with some other people that we know.
Well, I personally know somebody who has Asperger's, a young man, the son of a friend of mine, and he just recently got diagnosed, and now he's getting appropriate help, and he's a really, really smart guy, but he loses focus way too easily, and then he finally, because of, he's also very socially awkward and things like that, so I've never been violent, But we can talk to this individual and see if she would be willing to talk on the show because firsthand knowledge of what it is like to have somebody in your family who has Asperger's.
Yeah, I have a couple people as well that have some a child that's been diagnosed with that. It is, like I said, it's I hate to use the word interesting because it sounds like I'm on the outside looking in, which I am, and I don't want to take it lightly because I suspect that it is a major, major, major challenge in a family atmosphere. An autism spectrum disorder that is not associated with violence, and he lacked empathy for others. That's when I hear the empathy and the, you know, it's low and factual. I've been told that, you know, like if you say the sun is round, there is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's round. Don't tell me it's got a crooked side. Don't tell me it's oval. Don't tell. It's round. So they also have those issues. But we will talk about that. People who knew Lanza described him in contradictory ways. He was undoubtedly afflicted with mental health problems. Yet despite a fascination with mass shootings and firearms, he displayed no aggressive or threatening tendencies. The report says, in some context, Adam was viewed as having above-average intelligence, and in other contexts, below-average intelligence. Some people said he had been bullied, but others, including many teachers, said he wasn't. He was 6 foot tall and weighed 112 pounds. I guarantee you people made fun of him. Nancy and Peter Lanza, who were divorced, said Adam was bullied growing up, the report says. Peter said the bullying was not excessive and concerned Adam's social awkwardness and physical gait. I rest my case. USA Today interviewed 4 classmates after the shooting and said all students did not bully him. And the report says Adam appears to have had few friends growing up. Adam's father, Peter, saw him regularly until he was 18. They went hiking and played video games and went shooting twice. Adam had a cell phone but never used it. His father had to contact him by email. See, that little thing has been mentioned a couple times now in this story, this email thing. That would give me cause for alarm. I'd want to know what was going on. But Adam's relationship with his father deteriorated on the fourth quarter of 2010, the last time the two saw one another. Prior to December 2012, Adam stopped responding to his father's mail and email without getting together. One witness said he did not have emotional connection with his mother. When Nancy Lanza asked him if he would feel bad if anything happened to her, her son replied, no, the witness said. That's pretty sad, too. Other witnesses, though, said Lanza was close to his mother and that she was the only person he would talk to. The person who knew him in 2011 and 2012 said Lanza described his relationship with her as strained because he thought her behavior was not rational. The report says Lanza often changed clothes during the day and his mother did his laundry daily. She was not allowed in his room even to clean. Lanza disliked birthdays, Christmas holidays, and didn't allow his mother to put up a Christmas tree. She explained that by saying Adam had no emotions or feelings. Shooting was a family pastime, and Lanza enjoyed shooting and going to a target range with his mother and brother, the report says. He and his mother took a National Rifle Association safety course. He played violent and nonviolent video games often, but both solo and online. His favorite at one point was Super Mario Brothers. An acquaintance who played music and dance video games called Dance Dance Revolution with him in 2011 and 12 said Lanza never mentioned having been bullied growing up. The acquaintance said Lanza enjoyed nature and hiking and sometimes laughed and smiled and made dry jokes. With the release of the summary report, the investigation is closed and no additional release or information of documents by this office is anticipated. That's from the state attorney, Steven Sadinsky. He didn't release recordings of 911 emergency calls made on December 14th. Their release was recommended by a state Freedom of Information Commission in September. But Sadinsky, in an attempt to protect victims' families, has gone to court to stop the release. The shooting shattered the small, close-knit Western Connecticut community and raised several national issues. President Obama went to Newtown on December 16th to comfort the families who lost loved ones, then pushed for new gun control laws. Proposed legislation has not been passed by Congress, but Connecticut and some other states implemented stricter gun laws. The shootings also prompted many communities to take steps to make schools more secure and began debates about the effectiveness of the nation's mental health system. Amen. Release of summary report followed months-long debate among Connecticut officials, news outlets, and open government advocates and others over the public's right to know the pain such a report could inflict on families who lost relatives in the shootings. I think that was a very well-written story, and I actually, it gave me a little bit of peace last night to read it because I've thought about this so many times, and to lose that many people, so many people just starting out in their life, was certainly one of the most horrendous things that has happened in my lifetime, and of course there's been more than one. But I do think a couple of really, really good points. First of all, I wonder if you know the answer to this, Shelley. Isn't it true that in a state, even if they don't pass a law, in most states, can't they govern their own gun laws in a state?
You know? Well, either way, it has to be a law, though. I mean,
well,
so
they could make it a law, but can't they make it a part of their own state legislation? Can't the governor of the state say, okay, we're gonna put this into action, and until, well, they said that they made some changes, so they must have some ability to make some changes, but maybe not enough to. Make it punishable by not doing it the way they say, but I still think that
it's a really good question. I know how states enact laws. Obviously they don't have to go to the Congress or the Senate state by state to do state laws, but I don't know how state laws are enacted. I'm assuming there has to be some sort of regulatory agency or part of the state government that then has to vote on those laws. I don't think a governor can just say, I'm enacting this law today and it goes into effect. I mean, there has to be, I'm assuming there's a little bit more red tape than that, certainly easier than getting a federal law passed, but this would be something really good to find somebody in local government, and we know a couple people, who can answer those type of questions for us, because I think that's a very good question and I don't know the answer.
I'd be interested in finding that out as well, because if we go back to the Wild Wild West, right, way back in the day, and of course we didn't have the kind of government that we have today, and nobody Twittered and tweeted and all of the above, but, I mean, if you read history, certain towns, you checked your guns when you came into town, and certain towns abided a brothel, and certain towns didn't. So I'd be interested to know, too. Let's both of us do a little bit of research on that and see, first of all, you'll probably understand it. It will take me reading it four or five times before I get it. But I would like to research that and see if that's true. And I understand that a congressman can't say, okay, in the state of Florida, we're not going to do this anymore and, like it or lump it to the government. I get that. But I'm still thinking that if you live in the state of Florida and our governor, has a meeting of his mind and says, what do you think in the state of Florida? I mean, because that's what they've been doing with some of the other things that we've talked about, like gay marriage, as a for instance.
Mm-hmm.
No, each state has
still had to go through a process locally. That's why it took so long. You still have to have the voters vote on laws. But like I said, I'm sure it's a less time consuming process than trying to pass a federal law, because then you have to get all states to vote on it. but there's still some sort of an electrical process where the constituents, you know, a law is presented and then voted on. Just like the what I went to recently about legalizing marijuana. I mean, they're having this debate because that law is coming up to be voted on, you know, by the people who live in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that whole debate was happening, so that people would know both sides of the issue before they vote. So
Right. But again, I think that kind of tells us that they can do it statewide, and that if they make it a federal law, then it's a different, you know, it's a little bit further up the ladder. But just kind of answered our own questions just by what we've seen already happen. But we will research that, and if any of you out there are involved in something like this and can give us some answers, that would be awesome. We'd love to hear them. I do very quickly want to let everybody know that I have just recently become a part of the Greenhouse for Sober Living for Women. And it's a beautiful place out here in my neck of the woods. And it's a transitional home for women over the age of 18 who have gone on the wagon and have gone through a 12-step program and have detoxed and have themselves to a very sober place, but empty, and in some cases without the ability to function out there in the real world. So this is a beautiful home, and it is comforting. It is country atmosphere, warm, inviting, and beautiful. And if any of you know of anybody who's trying to make the transition from a 12-step program, a 30-day detox, please let me know on Facebook. We have some openings right now, which is unusual. And the holidays are approaching, and I know that this is a tough time for people with those kind of challenges. So it is beautiful. I've been to many in my lifetime with other people and supported other people that are staying in them. I have never been any place like this. It's brought to us by a lady who has been there, done that, and her understanding of what is needing is very, very high understanding. So let me know, and if there's somebody who would like to talk to me personally, you know that you're always welcome to call me, and you can get a hold of me on Facebook, or you can call me on the show. 347-989-0352 is the guest call-in number, and you're always welcome to call us and let me know that you need some help in that regard. I'm happy to help. I want to wish everybody a great day today, though. I think today's show gave us some questions that we need to answer, and Shelley and I will work on those and see if we can come up with some more information, so that we understand what's going on out there. And remember, the more everybody talks, the more we listen. And it's a big part of how we survive and get through this life. I want to thank everybody for today and tell you all, if you're living in South Florida, it's a very, very rainy, rainy, rainy day. And if you go someplace, take your umbrella, and even dropped a little bit, which is unusual for us here lately especially, but it's like in the 70s, high 70s, but in the 70s. And our Thanksgiving day is supposed to be pretty chilly. So I hope everybody has a wonderful day today. I want to send out best wishes to the young man that I mentioned yesterday. He's 13 years old. His name is Danny Conley, and he had such a severe asthma attack that he quit breathing and actually had a heart attack at 13. So I will be speaking to his dad this morning. Please send out prayers and good energy to that family. 18 years old. You know what that's like, if that's your... So, thanks, everybody. Love you. Have a wonderful day. Bye, Shell. Thank you.
Bye, Renee. Have a wonderful day, everyone.